Let's make it happen, Captain!
From deep inside Death Star, I'm Larry Larson.
And I'm Gov Maharaj.
Welcome back to Defrag. If people only knew what you said just before the show started, the best quotes will be lost forever. All right, so let's get started. We're back from a short little break. We had the Windows 8 consumer preview launch.
Yep.
Went very well. Looks awesome.
Yeah, it was a great day. Leap year, man.
Started installing on some machines at home last night. And yeah, awesome. And so let's get started. So we got the first one from Philip Frabot, maybe Frabot. We are not entirely sure, but it says, you guys do an awesome job, and I recommend your show to friends all the time. I get bumped to the top, right? What have we done? What did I do? Question, I have music that I like to stream from my computer or my Xbox 360 over my network. I can set this up as a share on the desktop, and it plays correctly on the Xbox. The problem, however, is that when I do this, the system never goes into sleep mode when the Xbox is not in use. It runs all the time. I try to conserve electricity as much as possible. I'd like to get to go to sleep before I open the share. By the way, I use the control panel's advanced sharing settings, media streaming options to set this up. I know why this happens. I can confirm that this is staying awake from power config requests. What I want to have is a script that I can run, PowerShell maybe, that will enable media streaming when I want to use my Xbox, and another that I can use to disable it. Unless there's some other way, which I'm missing, to get the system to continue sharing all the time but allow the system to sleep when it's not sharing anything. Ideas. If the system slept when you're not sharing anything, what happens when you then want to do it? It wouldn't be there is the problem.
That is generally the case, yes.
So,
I mean, if your system's asleep, Xbox is going to try to connect. There's nothing there to connect to.
Yeah.
You have to wake it up. Occasionally, I'm not actually 100% certain if the Xbox sends a wake on LAN packet, but of course that won't actually work if you're connected over wireless.
Mm-hmm.
Wake on LAN packets actually need to be wired, usually.
Yeah.
In this particular case, I mean, there's a couple of different approaches. What you could do is set up a script to manually sleep the machine, you know, at particular times.
Yeah.
So you get at least some power-saving benefits. If you're connecting with the Xbox using Media Center Extender, you can wait. You can check the event logs for what event that is when you're logging in, and then check when you're logging out, and then you can trigger a scheduled task based on that to also sleep your machine. But if you're using the media streaming options, you're basically, you know, you're kind of stuck with that particular mode. You know, the design is that you have a server. It's designed for server-style
yeah.
machines, and server-style machines don't tend to sleep.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right, from David Williamson. Spurned by a recent discussion on Windows reboots when performing installations, does a Windows group happen to include a PowerShell script or the like in a standard Windows installation to shut down all non-essential processes and services? So Windows group being the provider is they're the ones in the know about essential, and they know the progression of breaking up the dependencies as each Windows version progresses. This is one that we went back and forth on some email. You did, anyway, while I was on vacation. So tell us a little bit about this one.
This one is, you know, there's never really a simple answer to these kinds of questions.
Yeah.
Because of various factoring that has occurred across OS releases, we are more resilient to reboots. You know, we don't want to reboot the machine.
Yeah. What he's talking about was I had a flattened machine and I was like, you know, I've got 50 drivers to install or, mm-hmm. you know, a whole bunch of things I need to do. And it wants to reboot every time. Do I really need to do that?
Mm-hmm. And we talked about this in the last show, right? In order to be the most resilient, to ensure that you're doing the updates correctly,
yeah.
And not to incur any kinds of unknown risk,
yeah.
you do actually want to reboot.
One driver steps on another on the reboot and stuff like that. So
right. But in general servicing, you know, where you're actually servicing a DLL mm-hmm. in a regular component or a regular application, we have something called the Restart Manager API. So the best made applications register themselves with the Restart Manager API so they can get notifications of when something needs to replace files. It can say, oh, I can shut down now and then restart myself automatically when everything is done. The real problem with having some kind of built-in PowerShell script to say, you know, I know what the Windows services are, or Windows processes that are critical to the OS that, you know, you can shut down everything else, is that there are things in the everything else category that could be critical as well.
Yeah.
You don't want to shut down something like your hard drive RAID service. you know, the Intel controllers, for example, they often have a service associated with it. It's not part of Windows.
Mm-hmm.
We'd have to continually keep up very, very quickly on those types of third-party essential services and essential processes. You don't want to take out your video card service, for example. You know, you don't want to say, yep, that's not Windows. We can just clobber that one. So there's nothing built in. One of the cleanest things that you can do is log out of your account and then log back in mm-hmm. again. Then you start doing all of your updates. It'll make sure if you don't have a lot of things in your startup items that they're not running yet. So that's probably the best thing that you can do is take things out of your startup that don't need to be started up, quickly log out and log back in when you want to install updates.
Cool. Okay. All right, this one's from Dave Garbox. He says, hey guys, just want to say that I've recently started watching the show and look forward to it every week now. Welcome, Dave. My work machine is a custom-built workstation. I've noticed over the months that every so often it will randomly restart when installing something. I'm running Windows 7, X64, Core i5, 8GB RAM. Started installing both applications and Windows updates. At first, I thought it was because of .NET Framework being corrupted in some fashion, as I noticed it would restart more frequently when installing .NET-related updates or tools. I ran the .NET Framework Cleanup tool from Microsoft and reinstalled .NET Framework 4 and any updates without issues, but just this morning I tried to install an FTP client. Should be unrelated to the .NET Framework, I would hope, and the system rebooted. There's no blue screen. The machine just restarts. I thought it was a hard drive or a RAM issue, but both have been replaced and still the issue persists. Was wondering if it could be a power supply problem at this point. If not, is there a way I can potentially track down the problem through the event viewer?
Absolutely. In the event viewer, check out the system event log. Look for the event log entry, and you'll see two of those. You know, one is shutting down, one is starting up. It's
yeah.
the first and last service to start, generally speaking. Look around those times for an event that says, last system shutdown was unexpected.
Yeah.
You know, that will tell you that, you know, it's either a bug check, or you know something else critical happened, an NMI, a non-maskable interrupt. It could be a potential overheating issue. If that's the case, what you want to look for is under your system root, generally see Windows, look for memory.dmp. If that exists for you know a recent one,
mm-hmm.
You know shoot us a link to that. You know
yeah.
upload it and we can take a look.
Cool. Okay. All right. That's a good start. Next question. Hi, I watch a show and love it. Gove is the smartest person in the world and Larry is super cool. I want to search an Outlook.
You don't need to blatantly lie.
I know. This is a question for me. I sent on vacation. I want to search an Outlook across all folders or delete it if I can't do it all. So I want to search across all folders or one if you can't do that and find emails from people that I only have 5 or less emails from. If I sort by senders, it's pretty easy to pick them out to delete because one-offs are almost always spam. But I'm looking for a way to search for them and delete en masse. Love, Larry on the beach in Florida. So this is one that I sent you. I was sitting on the beach deleting stuff off my phone, and I just wanted to delete. I remember that, you know, most of the time when I get a one-off email from mm-hmm. someone, it's something that I don't need to keep.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, I haven't gotten an email from that email address before. So I want to be able to search for those across my mailboxes and or across my folders. And you said?
The built-in search into Outlook is a little bit limited.
Mm-hmm.
However, Office and their infinite wisdom have created something called an advanced query builder, but it's not enabled by default.
So you sent me this link, which I think is probably the most awesome thing that I saw the entire week, and I went all over the place. So
yes, addictivetips.com. This is just the most easily available version of this particular tip, so I didn't have to write out everything for you.
Yeah. So there's a few things that you need to do first to set up your machine to be able to do this.
Yeah, so you have to enable it through the registry. It's, you know, technically speaking, undocumented. So, you know, yes, you can use it. It's in Office 14. If it's not there in future versions of Office, that's too bad.
Caveat emptor. It works
yep.
for now, and that's what matters to me.
Yep, exactly. It works for now. Who knows? It could actually be fully integrated in later versions of Office, in which case you don't need to do this anymore.
Or this just might not work,
or it might not
work.
Be different. Or there's a third party.
We have to update this.
Yep, absolutely.
We're just saying. Things change.
So, yeah, there's a reg key that you can enable the feature, which gives you a new option in your ribbon for advanced search custom. And now you can do this interesting little query builder that is almost SQL-like.
It's awesome. It is incredible. This is exactly what I wanted.
Well, that's great. You know, there's essentially every field that you can possibly search for,
yeah,
and build an advanced query system for it, not just a simple from to, you know, date, does it have attachment, which the existing, yeah, query builder, yeah, looks like. And was this able to actually get you everything that you needed?
Yes, this was exactly what I was looking for.
Oh, this is
so all... I'm going to go in there today and mm-hmm. Start cleaning out stuff and use this for all kinds of things. I love this.
It is very handy. Hopefully, you know, maybe the office group will get some comments about this and they will flesh out this particular feature a little bit more, and maybe we'll see it in a mainline version someday.
Awesome. Next question from Derek Tate. He says, I work in a pretty decent-sized place where I'm currently a contractor. They do not allow developers access to production machines. The problem is that not enough tracing is turned on, or on occasion I need to log onto a machine to look around for things that are not always easy to describe. Thought, is there a way to create a read-only account for a Windows machine, kind of like the ones that used to exist on Unix? Not sure if you had that in your background. Of course you did. The account should be limited in all ways except for the ability to log on and look at settings.
So the problem with the concept of this is that most administrative tasks, even looking at particular logs, are sensitive in nature,
yeah,
right? So you, generally speaking, don't want to have someone that is only capable of limited rights to be able to look at things that are highly sensitive,
mm-hmm,
which is why we tend to put them into an administrative mode. And if you're in administrative mode, then you should have... enough trust, like in whomever you're giving this admin mode to be able to read and write.
Yeah.
It's somewhat counterintuitive to say, yes, you have all of this power to read all of the sensitive information about this machine, which is, you know, security related, which we consider sensitive,
mm-hmm,
and yet not be able to change anything.
Yeah.
There are certain things that you can, of course, do to craft some additional rights onto a standard user to be able to look at some things, but mostly speaking, this is not really possible. And even in the Unix world, it wasn't all that helpful.
Yeah, yeah. So there is your answer. All right, next question from Ismail Dini. He says, great show. My question is, why when you play first-person shooters on a computer with a shared set of mouse and keyboard through Mouse Without Borders, the sensitivity of the mouse goes out of control? I've had the same problem when I play, for example, Crysis 2 through remote FX enabled server. The problem doesn't occur on any other circumstances I've run into or in non-first-person shooter games. I would say that's probably not a good idea to play a video game on a machine that's part of a Mouse Without Borders setup.
True.
Video games tend to be kind of their own environment when they run.
That is true.
And it's not like you can play, you know, a bunch of different video games on four different machines and just move your mouse around.
Right.
There's things that happen there.
This is one of those examples where we recommended, you know, contacting us through email.
Yeah.
And we actually have been going back and forth with this. The symptoms are interesting enough that, yes, while it's not technically supported,
yeah,
it's interesting to understand at least what's going on. So this particular user sent me some additional information of, you know, which game that he's playing that has this, and I've got
and
access
so
to it.
So you're going to recreate this by playing the game for a couple
hours. I
want
to at least try to recreate this. The other aspect of this is not just Mouse Without Borders, it's remote FX.
Yeah.
So there's clearly something going on in the translation layer of making mouse somewhat erratic.
Yeah.
For all I know, it could be a bug, but this particular scenario, I can definitely say, is not one that is remotely standard.
Mm-hmm.
So it could easily be a corner case that nobody had thought of.
Yeah. Cool. So you've got a lead on this, though. And
yeah, absolutely.
We'll let you know what happens with this one. Cool. All right. Next question from Jerry Nixon. Hi, I have a funny problem. I have Windows Ultimate with Office 2007. Every time I try to install Office 2010, it freezes. It looks like it's working, but hours later, I just kill it. Literally, I've left it running a full day. I've tried multiple times. Safe mode didn't help. Where would you start? I would start by installing the old Office first, and then I'd do a clean boot of Windows and try it again. I'll put a link on there what I'm talking about with the clean boot of Windows.
Mm-hmm.
But you wanted some more details, and we haven't gotten those back yet on this one.
Actually, no, we did. I
think
he might have taken the show alias off,
okay,
offline. we actually did resolve this particular problem. So going back and forth, technically speaking, Office 2007 and Office 2010 can coexist on the same machine. Mm-hmm. He didn't actually need 2007 anymore. But he was having problems actually removing 2007.
Okay.
So there is a support article on Microsoft.com about actually cleanly removing Office 2007 if anything might be left on the system. There is some cases of the 2007 setup engine and the 2010 setup engine not getting along in some very edge cases.
Yeah.
So the end all of this was that we actually got 2007 cleanly off the machine, and he was able to install 2010 without any issues after that.
Cool. So there you have it. All right. And send me a link, and we'll put that in the show notes.
Yeah.
All right. Next question. Is it possible to connect video chat on Kinect Xbox with more than one person? I can do a Kinect video chat with another member, but I can't do it with more than one member, and I can't see how. The thing that you want to use, we'll put a link to this, is Avatar Kinect. And Avatar Kinect will let you, I believe, chat with up to 7 other people, and it uses avatars as your people. If you go to the next link here, you can see kind of what this looks like. And I think there's a picture down below, too. And so, you can do this with this app. It's a free app, and it'll allow you to sit and chat with a bunch of your friends using Kinect.
This is pretty cool.
Yeah, as an avatar, too.
Which really, we all really just want to be our avatars, don't we?
That's true. And, you know, as computing power gets faster, I think it'll all be about our avatars. You typically don't want to do a video chat because you don't, I mean, you might be in your pajamas or something like that. But if you can be your avatar, and if your avatar looks very...
Can always be wearing a
much
suit.
Like
I could be like James Bond all the time.
Yeah, you could be wearing a tie all the time.
Maybe Indian James Bond.
Yeah. So, and if you get out of this and you scroll down, I think they've got a picture, too, of what that looks like when you're sitting around in a powwow. There you go. So you can sit around with all your friends and have virtual avatar discussions.
In lawn chairs.
That's important. Old.
We're tailgating.
I haven't seen a lawn chair like that in a long time, but that is awesome.
I used to have lawn chairs like this.
I did, too. They used to fray all the time.
But they were comfortable.
They were.
They're a lot more comfortable now than the chairs that have the bars that bend.
Yeah.
The collapsible four-post chairs that you get at, Fred Meyer or something.
And, yeah, any more lawn chairs, it's all about the molded plastic things. I don't want that like these. All right. So, pick of the week. So, this week, you know, we do want to mention again that the Windows 8 Consumer Preview is available.
But there's even more cool stuff that's happening outside of that comes out of our Microsoft Research.
There is. So, there's the Microsoft Research Demos Interactive Transparent 3D Desktop. This is a very cool thing that you can watch a video on this and see what MSR is working on over there. And it's a way to interact in 3D with a screen that lets you kind of see through it. So you can have your hands underneath the screen and to be able to interact with the objects. Here we go. All right. So, yeah, watch this video. You can check it out. You can see how they interact with 3D objects in here. Very cool. It gives some interesting ideas for things that you could do in the future with a desktop that actually has depth to it. It's very interesting.
I can see how graphic designers, architects, CAD, being able to manipulate car models, all that kind of stuff would be extremely useful here.
Yeah, and usually when you're interacting with those things, you're using some kind of controls in front of you. You don't actually have your hands on that.
Mm-hmm.
So it's interesting to see this. It's it'll be cool to see where this goes. Look at that. There you go. So this is just the beginning, and we expect more coolness out of MSR. We'll have to go over and visit with Benko, see what's going on over there.
Some very smart people over there.
Cool. That's the show for this week. If you want to email us, you can email us at defragshow@microsoft.com. You can leave a message in the show notes or send us an email so we can go back and forth with you.
We definitely like the back and forth.
Cool. See you next week.